visitors. We've mentioned it a couple of times, but we're glad that you're here. If you are here for the first time or you haven't filled one of these out before, there should be some right in front of you on the back of the seat. We would appreciate it if you would fill one of these out and hand it to pretty much anyone who's not already holding one, because they might be visiting too and they wouldn't know what to do with it. So fill one of those out and give it to somebody, and we'd be glad to know that you were here. We'd appreciate it. Turn, if you would, to John chapter 13. We're going to be spending our time in the first 20 verses of John chapter 13. We've been going through the Gospel of John together, and after we read it, we'll spend a few minutes just kind of getting our bearings and then talk about the story that's contained here. But let's begin by reading John chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it in the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash, except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him. That was why he said, "Not all of you are clean." When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen. But the scripture will be fulfilled: he who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me." So John 13 begins what is commonly known as the farewell discourse. John 13 through 17 record conversations and teaching from the evening before Jesus's betrayal and trials and death, the passion. So John 18 through 20 then will go on to describe those things, the passion. The farewell discourse itself, chapters 13 through 17, is divided kind of into two main sections. Chapter 13 and 14 take place during and directly after the Last Supper, the meal that Jesus eats with his disciples before his betrayal. And then at the end of chapter 14, verse 31, Jesus and his disciples get up and they leave the room where they had eaten to head toward the Mount of Olives. And they'll get to the Mount of Olives at the beginning of chapter 18. So chapters 15 through 17 take place on the walk as they travel to the garden. Now, before we talk about what is in chapter 13, it might be helpful to consider what's not there. This is, as I mentioned, the evening of the Last Supper. In John chapter 13 and verse 2, when John mentions that this is during supper, that's the meal that he's talking about. This is the Passover meal that Jesus had desired to eat with his disciples. This is the Passover meal at which Jesus transforms that Old Covenant memorial and makes it about himself with the Lord's Supper or the communion or the Eucharist, whatever you want to call it. But John doesn't mention that part of the evening, which is odd considering its significance. John's is the only gospel to leave it out, to omit the institution of the Lord's Supper. John's gospel is also the only one to include this story, the description of foot washing that took place that night. So as we consider this story, we should be mindful, I think, of what John chose not to mention and consider the impact of what he does mention. It may help us to understand the importance of the foot washing. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But for now, briefly consider two possible reasons why John might have left out the institution of the Lord's Supper. First reason, as we've mentioned before in this study, John's gospel is very likely the last of the four gospels to be written. So by the time John writes his gospel, he would have at least been familiar probably with Matthew and Mark's gospels, maybe with Luke's as well. So John may have felt free to leave out certain things that he knew had already been covered sufficiently in those other records. He also might have felt it important to include things that those other records had left out, like the foot washing. So John might have thought, you know, they already know the story of this evening, they already know the institution of the Lord's Supper well, but they don't know this part of that night. The second possible reason is that it wouldn't be accurate, really, to say that John doesn't mention the Lord's Supper at all. Because, if you remember, a while back we were in John chapter 6. And John used very specific language in John chapter 6 in the story of Jesus feeding the multitudes and then giving the bread of life discourse, I am the bread of life. John described Jesus as taking the bread, having given thanks, and then giving it to the crowds. Those particular words, the Greek word for took, the word for bread, the word for giving thanks, and the word for giving or distributing it, all of those words are words that are found elsewhere in the institution of the Lord's Supper accounts. So in Matthew 26, and in Mark 14, and Luke 22, and in 1 Corinthians 11. All of those accounts share those same terms that John used back in John chapter 6. As a matter of fact, the precise form of the verb for give thanks, eucharistissos, is found only in the New Testament in those five places. The four accounts of the institution of the Lord's Supper and John chapter 6. And it's the term, of course, from which we get the word Eucharist. So, this is the point. I don't think that it's fair to say that John doesn't talk about the Lord's Supper at all. Instead, I think John does something subtle. He's already alluded to the Lord's Supper, and pretty explicitly, in John chapter 6. He gave Jesus' bread of life discourse, in which Jesus took bread, gave thanks, gave it to the crowd, and then called on those who heard, who follow him, to eat his body and drink his blood. There's some connections there, quite obvious ones. But in his description of the night itself, in John 13, John, of course, knowing that his readers already know that particular part of the evening, and knowing that he's already provided some verbal signposts back in chapter 6, John chooses to mention something else significant that occurred that night and focus on it instead. So, with all that prep work behind us, let's get into John 13. The sad thing about being familiar with the Bible That seems like a strange thing to say. But the sad thing about being familiar with the Bible is that it's hard for us to read it with fresh eyes, to feel the shock that the writer intended for his readers to feel. I want you to notice that everything in verses 1 to 3 of John 13 is designed to build up the greatness of Jesus so that what happens in verse 4 will floor us. So John points out the supernatural knowledge of Christ in verse 1. Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of the world. John points out where Jesus is going. He's departing to the Father in verse 1. Verse 3, he had come from God and was going back to God. And at the beginning of verse 3, Jesus knows that the Father has given all things into his hands. So Jesus is from God, he's going back to God, and God has given him everything. That's the picture of Jesus at the end of verse 3. So what does Jesus do with that knowledge and with that power and with that authority? Well, verse 4, he rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Remember, as we discussed a few weeks ago when we were in John chapter 12, just how demeaning of a task this was. This wasn't something you did for other people. If anyone ever washed your feet for you, it would have been a slave. Respectable people didn't wash each other's feet. Respectable hosts didn't wash their guests' feet. You washed your own feet if they needed to be washed. And maybe if you were at a rich enough person's house, a slave would wash them for you. But you didn't wash your friend's feet. You certainly didn't wash your students' feet or your disciples' feet or your servants' feet. Keep in mind, too, that the proximity of this event to John chapter 12 in verses 1 through 8. Less than a week before, Jesus was at dinner, and Mary, sister of Lazarus, had done this very same thing for Jesus. She let down her hair, got down on her knees, and washed Jesus' feet. Mary did something humiliating, something socially demeaning, something socially taboo in order to express her gratitude and devotion to her Lord. And what we said was that even though her actions were socially shocking, they communicated an important point, that Jesus was worthy of it, that Jesus deserved that level of worship, that Jesus was worthy of excessive worship. He was worthy of such an offering and more, of everything that Mary had to give. So what's the problem when we come to John 13? What might we have expected Jesus to do? If Jesus were more like me, I could imagine him saying something to his disciples like, "Hey guys, you remember earlier this week when we were at dinner and Mary washed my feet? That was nice. I deserved that. I appreciated that. That was a worthy expression of worship to me. Who wants to wash my feet tonight?" But of course, Jesus is not like me. And so instead, the situation is completely upended, and something unthinkable happens. The Son of God, the creator of all, John chapter 1, the one who gives life to the dead, John chapter 11, the one who deserves all worship, John chapter 12, the one who has all things in his hands, John chapter 13, the one for whom the earth itself is a footstool for his throne, he kneels, gets on his knees before his disciples, and starts washing their filthy feet. So this is the Son of God who descended from God But he didn't just come down to earth. He came down and he went lower. He descended to earth not to demand our worship, but to evoke our worship through his service. Why would he do this? Well, it quickly becomes clear, I think, as we read this story, that this isn't simply about foot washing, and it isn't simply an object lesson. Part of the impact of this is going to be that Jesus tells his disciples they should serve each other as he has served them. In life, in foot washing, in countless daily ways, Jesus is going to say in verses 14 through 16 that servants are not greater than their masters. And so if Jesus, their Lord and teacher, lowered himself to this kind of service, how much more should they, as his servants, lower themselves to serve each other in the same way? If Jesus isn't too good to wash feet, neither am I. But very quickly in this story in John 13, we start to get the idea that Jesus' foot washing isn't just about foot washing. Four clues to mention quickly to that end. Clue number one, when Peter questions Jesus in verse 6, Jesus answers him in verse 7 by saying, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." You know, if this is just a straightforward object lesson for Jesus to teach his disciples that they shouldn't get puffed up but should act like servants, that seems like a strange thing to say. That's a pretty straightforward lesson. Why can't Peter understand it yet? As a matter of fact, Jesus' statement there in chapter 13 and verse 7 sounds like John's statement in chapter 12 and verse 16, where he says that the disciples didn't understand these things surrounding the triumphal entrance at first, but when Jesus was glorified, which is a code word for Jesus' death and resurrection, when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things had been written about him and had been done to him. So the disciples didn't understand everything at first, but after the glorification of Christ, then they could look back and realize what it meant. The second clue that the foot washing isn't just about foot washing is that when Peter continues to resist Jesus in verse 8, he says, "You shall never wash my feet," Jesus escalates things. He says, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me. If you don't let me wash your feet, then you and I have nothing to do with each other. You have no part with me." And that seems a little excessive, right? I mean, Peter's just trying to be humble. Peter's just recognizing that he should be the one serving Jesus and not the other way around. But what Jesus is symbolizing with the foot washing is so important that Jesus says anyone who rejects the foot washing, anyone who is not washed, has no share with him. Clue number three, quickly. The foot washing comes at a bit of an odd time. Normally, culturally, this was the kind of thing that you did when your guests arrived, right? People walk in off the street. We might ask them to take their shoes off if you're those kind of people. They would, when guests come in from the street with dirty feet, dirty sandals, they would wash. They would do the foot washing thing. They'd provide the bowl and they'd wash their own feet, or the slaves would wash. But it was something that would take place at the beginning of the evening. Jesus does this during supper, which is a bit of a strange time to choose to do it. Jesus does it during the meal, the Passover meal, the meal that readers would already have known was significant. And by tying the foot washing to the meal, it associates the foot washing with the meaning of the meal, the sacrificial death represented by the meal. Last clue, and probably most important clue, Jesus uses a key pairing of terms that he has used before. In John chapter 13 and verse 4, notice what Jesus does. He rises from supper, he lays aside his outer garments, and he takes up a towel to tie around his waist. That pairing of words showed up in John chapter 10, when Jesus was saying something pretty significant. In John 10, verses 17 through 18. "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again." You notice three times in those verses that pairing of terms shows up. Lay aside, take up. So the impact of all of these clues is to tell us that Jesus' action of washing his disciples' feet is symbolic. It's a sacrificial expression that points directly to what Jesus is going to do the following day on the cross. Jesus took the form of a servant in death as he had in life, suffering the humiliation of dying like a thief or a slave. And what does his sacrificial servitude accomplish on the cross? Well, by it his people are cleansed, right? So when several chapters later, but only a few hours later, we find the only other time that the text emphasizes Jesus' clothes getting removed in John chapter 19. The soldiers, in verse 23, take Jesus' garments, right? And they divide them amongst themselves. But Jesus has already prepared his disciples so that they can know his clothes and his life aren't really being taken from him. He's laying them down. And he can take them up again. And so even as the soldiers think that they're in control, and they divide up Jesus' garments into four parts or four shares, the word meros, what they have taken and divided into shares for themselves, Jesus has actually laid down of his own accord so that his disciples can have a share with him. You remember chapter 13 and verse 8. Those who Jesus washes have a share with him. And so Jesus, in John chapter 13, he lowers himself to commit this act of service, this act of cleansing, in order to teach his disciples something about the greater act of service and cleansing that he's going to accomplish the next day, when water will be poured out from his flesh. And then, after Jesus takes his garments back up again and resumes his place, which is an interesting phrase, he says, "You also should do just as I have done to you." So what's the impact of that instruction? By this point, I hope we recognize that this isn't simply an instruction to go around washing the feet of others, although that would certainly fall under the umbrella of service that Jesus is commissioning. This also isn't simply an instruction to live like servants, to humble ourselves and to serve others, although that too falls under the umbrella. There is more to it than that. No, I think this takes us back to what Jesus said in John chapter 12, verse 25 and 26. Whoever loves his... We're not there yet. John 12, 25 and 26. "Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also." If anyone serves Jesus, he must follow Jesus. That means where Jesus goes, where Jesus went, there his servant will go and be also. So the servant of Jesus will walk with Jesus to hear his teaching. The servant of Jesus will kneel with Jesus to serve those who are filthy. And the servant of Jesus will lay aside his garments and lay down his life with his master. Because that's where Jesus is going. Jesus is going to the cross. And he directs his disciples to follow him in sacrifice. That ultimate sacrifice is, of course, the culmination of a life of service. And such is the life that Jesus calls his disciples to. Christ calls us ultimately to die, but he also calls us to live lives of death, live lives of self-sacrifice. So Jesus sends his disciples forth with a directive to kneel, to serve, and to lay down their lives as he has done in service to them. And so, John 15, in verses 12 through 13, Jesus will say, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends." How has Jesus loved us? By laying down his life. And so we must love others. 1 John 3 and verse 16, "By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers." So Jesus sends forth his servants, he directs his disciples, but Jesus doesn't send his servants to do work that he was unwilling to do himself. Jesus sends his servants to do a task that he has modeled for them, a task that they have seen him do. And as he sends them, he prepares their hearts for the mission. Notice verse 20 of John chapter 13. Verse 20, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me." You know, that's the kind of responsibility that could puff up. If I get it in my head, I'm a representative of the Christ. I'm a representative of the King. I'm a messenger of God. People who receive me, they're receiving God. People who reject me, you know who they're rejecting. But even as Jesus sends his disciples with this kind of authority, this kind of representation of him, he prepares them by humiliating himself. If you receive me, you receive God. How important must I be? But this is a God who kneels. This is a God who washes feet. So if I represent that God, what kind of messenger must I be? What kind of person is that God's messenger? Well, obviously a servant, a foot washer. If that is what my master does, then that is what I am. The challenge of this story, I think, is that Jesus does not allow his disciples to separate his gift to them from his calling for them. He doesn't let them separate the offering from the order. Because the story begins with Jesus cleansing his disciples. Jesus cleanses us. His death makes us clean. His death washes us. And we are, just like the disciples were, infinitely undeserving of that gift. We did not earn it. We cannot pay it back. We do not warrant it. Jesus lowering himself to wash the feet of his sinful people is undeserved. It is grace. It is mercy. And so Paul says to Titus in Titus chapter 3 and verses 5 and 6, "He saved us not because of works done by us in righteousness, but according to his own mercy by the washing of regeneration and renewal of the Holy Spirit, whom he poured out on us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior." Notice some relation there to John chapter 13. So Jesus lowered himself to provide the sacrifice which cleanses our filthiness. But those who are clean, those who believe in him, those who follow after him, are called to imitate him. And we can't separate those two things from each other. So unlike the unforgiving servant of Matthew chapter 18, who was forgiven a great debt and refused to forgive one who had a debt to him. Unlike him, we treat others as Christ has treated us. We empty ourselves, we pour ourselves out as Christ emptied himself. You remember Paul saying that he is poured out as a drink offering. I wonder where he got that idea. We serve as Christ served. We suffer as Christ suffered. We cannot afford to separate Christ's gift from Christ's calling. So consider the disconnect in someone who thanks God for his food and for the sacrifice that Christ has given to him, and then turns around to snap at the waiter who's serving him. Consider the disconnect for the one who revels in his status as a disciple of Christ, as a representative of God, and sneers at the filthy sinners in the world as he carefully stays away from them so that he won't be contaminated. We cannot accept Christ's cleansing and then refuse to kneel in service to others as he did. We cannot pretend to be greater than the Master who descended into the muck of this world in order to help us and rescue us. And we cannot pick and choose who we will serve. It's not up to us to decide who is worthy of it. Jesus knelt before Judas in John chapter 13. Later on in the evening, in John chapter 13 and verse 30, Judas is going to leave the room. Now, you would think that Jesus might have waited a little while to wash feet because he knew that Judas would be out of there in a while. But instead, Jesus, knowing, John chapter 13 and verse 3, that the Father had given all things into his hand, Jesus, knowing, in verse 18, that the one who ate his bread would lift up his heel against him, Jesus knew what Judas was about to do. Jesus knew that the evil deed was already in Judas's heart at that very moment, and Jesus got down on his knees and washed Judas's feet. And so we cannot look at sinners and claim exemption from the call to Christ-like service because we don't think they're worthy of it. By kneeling to wash the feet of Judas, Jesus left us with no such outlet. So this is the God who presents himself to us in John chapter 13. A God who has all authority in heaven and on earth, a God who reigns supreme, a God who created all things, and yet a God who loves his creation so deeply, so greatly, that he descended from his throne, took the form of a servant, and knelt to wash the feet of sinners. That requires a response. You can't just look at that picture and decide that it's irrelevant. You either walk away, and in so doing, do what the writer of Hebrews said, and trample underfoot the Son of God. You know, the only way you can trample underfoot the Son of God is if the Son of God is on the floor. And that's where he is in John chapter 13. He's on the floor, kneeling, offering. And it's up to us whether we will receive that gift or reject it. If you're here and you're not a child of God, this is a good opportunity. You could make the decision publicly now as we sing the song that we're about to sing to confess Christ and to be cleansed by his sacrificial death on the cross. If you need more information or help or instruction, you can talk to anyone here. We can help you. We'd love to help you. If you need to respond to the call of the gospel, do so now as we stand and sing. I'm pressing on the upward way.
heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on heaven's table land, a higher plane than I have found. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. My heart has no desire to stay where doubts arise and fears dismay. Though some may dwell where these abound, my prayer, my aim is higher ground. Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on heaven's table land, a higher plane than I have found. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. I want to scale the utmost height and catch a gleam of glory bright, but still I'll pray till heaven I found. Lord, lead me on to higher ground. Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on heaven's table land, a higher plane than I have found. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Please be seated.